your job as the parent is not to deal with the emotions. Like I say all the time, it's your job to set the boundary. It's their job to have the feelings. And if you can kind of keep those things very separate, it makes it so much easier when you have toddlers, because then you don't fall into these power struggles.
I'm Dr. Kelly Brogan. You may know me as a New York Times bestselling author of a book with an exploding pill on the cover, renegade psychiatrist, pole dancer, or honorary member of the Disinformation Dozen. What can I say? I'm a born provocateur. I've spent most of my recent life exposing deceptions, connecting dots, and discovering the secret places my inner victim is still waiting to be liberated. And now I feel called to help you reclaim all of your parts, your health, your sexuality, your power, and your expression, so that you can finally truly own yourself. I want to ignite in you that inner knowing and the pulsing vitality that lives beneath your disempowerment, disconnection, and resentment, so that you can audaciously, courageously, and playfully alchemize your struggle into the specific pleasure of who you are. This is Reclamation Radio.
Welcome back to Reclamation Radio. I am Dr. Kelly Brogan, and today I speak with parenting coach Cassie Goodmanson. We get very real about how to reframe and reimagine parenting and mothering specifically. So we get into how mothers can stay grounded while navigating toddler tantrums, the importance of emotional self-regulation and how to access it, and what it is to break free from power struggles for good with your kids. So I intend for this conversation to shift your perspective and liberate you to an easeful and joyful experience of your kids, which is your birthright. Let's dive in.
Hi, Cassie, and welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm so excited to dive in.
Awesome. So as I was mentioning, I am always on the lookout for women who speak to the topic of mothering from and through the perspective of sovereignty, you know, the way I would describe it, which is essentially self-responsibility as a mother, as, you know, a parent in general, but specifically as a mother, the role of emotional regulation and how we subtly engage in victim triangle dynamics, even when we tell ourselves that we are doing this in the best interest of our child. So when I started to come upon your videos, I immediately recognized this shared intent. And because my girls are teenagers, I have very little access to counsel on the toddler years. It just feels like so many lifetimes ago, and it's very hard for me to honestly apply a lot of what becomes pretty easy to catch rhetorically in the, you know, verbal years, let's say, and the tween and teen years. You can really, in my opinion, monitor yourself as a mother and see when you are engaging in manipulative and, you know, fear-based tactics, control-based tactics. And I think it's probably a bit harder when your children are at this age, or at least it is from what I remember. So I wanted to zoom out, Cassie, because I know your primary credential is your motherhood, but you also have a background in several different modalities. And I wanted to just give you the opportunity to speak to your philosophy about mothering. You know, like what do you think is actually going on here? What do you think is the more spiritual dimension of the role that we play in these children's lives? And maybe from there we can hear a bit about where you think we've gone wrong, you know, or at least are unconsciously operating when it comes to mothering.
Yeah. I mean, I do not come from like a standard clinical psychologist background, or like I don't have an undergrad in child development or anything like that. So much of what I teach has just been my own research along the way. And then even in previous businesses before what I do now, I was more like the business world doing coaching and stuff. But so much of what I was doing was like emotional regulation for business owners and like connecting with your spirituality and kind of tuning in to like what's going on inside of you and how that reflects in your business. And so many of my clients were also moms. And so it just naturally was like trickling across to our conversations about, okay, this is what I'm doing in business, but like, how do I work through the mindsets and like the patterns that are coming up in motherhood too? And I have just pulled, you know, a lot of pieces of information. I also, one of my very dear friends who I work with in my business now, we work with moms together, is a clinical psychologist. So I kind of came to her and was like, here's how I see things. And she was like, yep. I can see how that's backed up by, you know, different pieces of research and different things that she learned in her background. But I have always, I think, since my very first pregnancy, approached motherhood differently than I think was the norm, than a lot of my friends did. I just wanted to do things differently. I mean, back then I was like digging into books and watching videos about like Rye parenting and Magda Gerber and like all of these other kind of alternative philosophies that like people didn't really know about even just 5 years ago. Because I just, even back then, I saw friends that had like toddlers or little kids and just were like struggling. Like they just kind of hated motherhood. And I was like, I don't want that. I don't want to go into this feeling like I'm going to have to trudge through the next 5 years before it gets good. Like there has to be something else that I can do here that's going to make this different. And I think with having my own background around like mindset and being very aware of my own emotions, my own patterns, so much of that was so helpful going into motherhood because I noticed a lot of where, you know, my like natural instincts as a mom were just triggers, were just like patterns that were coming up for me from my own childhood and from things like that. So I think like it was easier for me to catch that stuff and be aware of that and really shift how my motherhood has looked.
I have found that there are so many ways that the reflexive programs of I know better than you for you, if we could summarize them, come through our voices, right? So it's in the form of insisting that our kids have manners and be polite and obey and comply, that they serve our needs, literally serve our needs. And then we wonder where adult entitlement comes from, that they serve our needs, whether or not it suits them. And there are ways that we relate, especially to these very tender relationships that we form as humans to our environment and specifically through nurturance and through food, right? So the way that we control eating and how our kids, you know, understand their own body, we are a part, in my opinion, most of us, of the separation that gets induced between a spirit and a body, you know, that then gets commandeered by so much of dominant culture, let alone agendas and all the rest. But a lot of what you focus on is, of course, what I, in my work with adult women, end up, you know, attempting to unpack, which is the realm of emotional self-regulation, emotional self-mastery. And we wonder why we have all these attachment issues, why our relationships are dysfunctional, and why we literally can't feel a feeling without engaging a defensive strategy when we are parented to never be given the opportunity to feel our feelings. And I know that you agree. One of the only things I got right out the gate was the punishment thing. Even before I read Alfie Kohn's work or whatever, I knew based on my own childhood experience that I wasn't going to do the whole punishment thing. And it's funny because I was just traveling with my daughters and there was this cute little toddler on the airplane and he was crying. And the mom, we were walking past and the mom was like, "You're acting like a baby and everyone in the plane is going to be looking at you and I'm taking your iPad." Right? Like it was just like a summary of the shaming, the punishment and all the things. And I could watch my daughters reflect on what felt off about that. And then I also felt for that mom who probably has no idea that there is another way. So, you know, when it comes to unruly behavior, right? When it comes to so-called misbehaving or tantrums, what is your general perspective and what do you think is important for moms to bear in mind? Because that is the moment of emotional dysregulation that most of us experience, obviously, right? Like when our kid is screaming and they want something that we don't want to give them or we don't think that they should have, it sounds like a simple moment, and it can literally lead to the most injurious behavior that is normative. Like, yeah, it's socially accepted to behave in this way. And so obviously part of this conversation is the attempt to end that cycle and the root cause of so much of our relational issues. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you believe is the best way to approach a toddler's tantrum.
Yeah, I mean, that is like one of the things that I get asked about the most, that I talk about the most, because I feel like that is one of the most visceral ways that this really shows up when your little ones are young. And I mean, across the board, I think the place where most people have to start is realizing that the reason why tantrums are so hard for a lot of moms is just because it feels so triggering. And then realizing that it feels so triggering because, like, they were never taught, like you said, how to be with upset, frustration, anger, sadness, discomfort. Like, those emotions as the mom feel very unsafe. And like, so obviously your natural reaction when it feels unsafe is to shut it down, to stop it, to cut it off. Even if you know logically, like, it's normal for my toddler to have a tantrum in that moment, you're having this like physical body reaction to it. And so a lot of what I talk about is just noticing that and starting to be okay with, like, your job as the parent is not to deal with the emotions. Like I say all the time, it's your job to set the boundary. It's their job to have the feelings. And if you can kind of keep those things very separate, it makes it so much easier when you have toddlers, because then you don't fall into these power struggles. And I did a video the other week and I was talking about like handling my almost 2-year-old. He was having like a big meltdown about something. And I was talking about how like a lot of times people can get into these like spiraling power struggles where they start throwing out like random threats to get their toddler to stop. And something I said in the video was like, if you don't stop crying, you're not getting dinner for a week. And it was just like this, such a good explanation of like how we say things that are just like almost so absurd to get our kids to be like calm and pleasant and happy when like that none of that is needed, right? So I do like the least in those moments that I can in terms of like setting limits and boundaries. Like, as long as everybody is safe and like our house is safe, I let it be, right? Because in those moments, like, what your little ones really need is practice feeling and then regulating through their emotions. Like, they don't need, like you said, a punishment. They don't need this like major discipline moment. They don't need to be like logic or reasoned out of it. It's just like a moment for them to practice feeling their feelings. And that's it. And I feel like if you can kind of take a step back and not get so caught up in how it looks or how they're supposed to behave, or, you know, they're 3, they shouldn't be throwing tantrums anymore. Like, it's so normal. And it makes it easier to like enjoy the little years too. I think that's a huge reason why I have actually enjoyed these years, is because like the tantrums don't bother me. Like, it's just like, oh yeah, he's having feelings about it. That's told, like, he's allowed to have feelings about this. I have feelings about stuff too. And then we just like move on from that moment. And it's nothing more than that. You know what I mean? But again, it starts with like, you have to back up far enough into yourself being able to be okay with those feelings and them feeling safe for you as a parent.
Absolutely. Which is why I'm glad that I ended up where I ended up in terms of what I focused on, which is just the prioritization of just feeling these feelings as adults. It's everything. And it's literally as simple as it sounds, to just simply commit to feeling them and take the responsibility for your own feelings, rather than to require your child to regulate your own emotional state, which is, I mean, it's literally like how we end up with all the struggles we struggle with as adults. So I want to double click on this though, because I know a lot of folks are going to be wondering, okay, well, what do you mean by boundaries, and what do I do that in that case, right? So if the options, so your kid is on the airplane screaming, let's say just this instance I brought up, and you feel pressure, right? So this pressure is often imagined, whether you're at home or you have to go somewhere or whatever, but you feel some pressure to conform to an expectation that you're bringing to the moment. And so we often, these are the options I sort of remember feeling available to me. So you can punish, right? So you can say, I'm going to take your iPad. You're not going to eat dinner for a week, whatever it is. Let alone, obviously, further on the spectrum, which is like, you know, physical aggression, grabbing arms, spanking, whatever. You can incentivize by coupling some reward that has nothing to do with, you know, what's going on. You could distract. You could try to verbally engage, right? Like use your words kind of a situation. Or, you know, what I would have heard if I heard what you said back in the day was actually what I often did because I didn't have a lot of tools for self-regulation. However, I was very committed to not punishing or yelling. And so I would just withdraw, like emotionally, right? So I would either sometimes be like, you know, I'll be in the other room or something like that. Or I would just emotionally withdraw, which is a form of punishment, even if it looks more benign. It's like ignoring. Dismissing the situation. So I'm imagining it's not going to look like any of those in your ideal world. So what might be maybe an example of a scenario and how you would like, what literally would you say and how would you interact with the situation?
Yeah, I mean, those are all like pretty spot on, I think, with what I see a lot. And I think there's a lot of focus in the online parenting world about like, how do you stop yelling? How do you stop being kind of this like forward-facing, aggressive. But I think just as often are the people, and like myself, my tendency is like the freeze, shut down, being like, I'm done with this. This straight up kind of ignoring them sort of situation, which again, isn't helpful because they're still not learning anything about, which like the ultimate goal in these moments is that they're, again, starting to learn that skill of like regulating themselves. So I think what I tend to do looks most closely, like from the outside, like the kind of shutting down, ignoring, because it's very calm, it's very quiet, it's very understated, but it's different. And the energy is different and the intention behind it is different. And I feel like that's small, but it's really important because it's very much, I come into it with this approach of like, I'm here to help, but I can't control this. So it's very much like, I know you're having a hard time. I'm here. And while I don't say a lot of words, because especially when your little ones are small, they're in a tantrum, talking so much at them can almost make it worse a lot of times, right? Like they're already dysregulated, giving them like one more thing that their brain is trying to process. If you're like, you almost go into like trying to fix it mode can make it worse. And so I tend to be pretty quiet, but it's a very like focused, present energy. It's very much like, I'm making eye contact. If they want a cuddle, they're getting a cuddle. I'm like right there in their space with them. Like, I hear you. This is really hard. A lot of times I will model like some sort of regulating thing, whether it's like taking deep breaths or like I do a lot of like shaking my body out that like helps me regulate. And again, not even like telling my toddler to do it. I'm not like, take a deep breath. I'm just doing it, right? I'm doing it in front of them. That is enough often for them to kind of meet my energy where it's at. Their nervous system, their brain is absorbing that calm from me, and then they're going to come back down. Obviously, like especially in public settings, the hardest part of this is kind of shutting out everything around you, not being so focused on the other people that you're feeling, you know, judged or pressured to like get your kid to calm down. And I think that just comes with practice. That just comes with practice of learning to be unbothered by other people's perception of you as a mom or how good of a job you're doing or other people's annoyance or grumbling or whatever that your kid is having feelings. And I think the more you do it, the easier it is to kind of ignore all of that and just be able to like laser in and focus on your kid. But like that's all it is. Like it really is not more than that until they kind of start to calm down a little bit. Get more regulated out of it.
So one of the things that I talk about is how we are not exposed as children to the natural arc of an emotion, right? So we're told to calm down, to, you know, stop crying, you're okay, all of this gaslighting, you know, kind of behavior. And so when we are confronted by intense emotions as adults, we often imagine that we're going to like fall into the abyss, you know, or the crying is going to start and it's going to be like a tidal wave that never stops. And so we don't have a lived experience of the beginning, middle, and end of an emotion. So what I hear you suggesting is that you know, the co-presence and the intention to do so, which especially if you feel like the victim, right? Like, especially if you feel like your child is doing you wrong in that moment, and you feel your heart close down and you feel unavailable to them emotionally, it requires your own inner work, right? To just be present, to just be attentive, let alone to offer a word or two of, you know, reflection. You know, you seem upset, this seems hard, you know, whatever it might be. And you're so whatever it requires for you to do with your body, take a breath, you know, shake your hands off, shake your body around, you do that. And then your child goes through the arc. And then how do you recommend communicating, right? Because I think this concept of boundaries is such a diluted term at this point, means 100,000 things to 100,000 different people. And often I think people use the term boundary to cloak punishment and disconnection. And so I wonder what you mean by that. And is that the time that you would start to establish, like if there's hitting or throwing going on, like, is that the time that you would start to establish something like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I say boundary, what I mean is always something that you can do as the parent that's just going to keep everybody safe. Like I say this, I said this before, but just is keeping everybody safe. Like, especially in the moment, a boundary is not like, if you do that again, you're going to your room, or I'm like, you're never seeing this toy again. Or like you said, it's not a punishment. It's not a threat. It's just, I can see that you're hitting. I'm going to hold your hand, right? It's just like this very gentle, firm, clear, but like, it's just there to keep everybody safe. And then what I always teach and what I always do is the time for like teaching, especially in the toddler years with like tricky behaviors and things like that, the time for teaching is later. When they're calm, when they're happy throughout your day, that's when I would be asking myself, like, okay, if my toddler is really having a hard time with hitting, every time they're upset, they're frustrated, they're sad, they want attention, they're hitting, then I'm going to address that throughout my day. I'm going to ask myself, where is the hitting coming from? What need is it trying to communicate? And how can I teach them other ways of getting that, right? Maybe if it's like every time they're frustrated, they're hitting, then I'm going to be doing like games or activities with them that are other ways that they can get their frustration out. Maybe it's literally just like throwing a beanbag at the floor, or maybe it's like hitting a baseball or whatever. Like, we're giving them another skill, because we can't expect them to stop that kind of instinctual behavior if we don't give them a healthier way of dealing with it. If we're just coming in from this perspective of like, hitting is not nice, right? I hear that one a lot with little kids. That's not nice. But then like a two-year-old doesn't know what nice means. They don't know what else to do. They still have the feeling of frustration in their body. There's nothing else to replace that. They need it to go somewhere. So in the calm moments, in the other moments of your day, is when I'm kind of working on those skills, games, other behaviors, just like naturally throughout my day. And then in the moment, again, we're like co-regulating and I'm like, I can't let you hit. So I'm going to gently block your hands, or I'm going to move you over here. Like, we're going to go over here away from the baby if you're having a hard time being safe around the baby. We're just like, it's very clear, calm boundaries in the moment. But that, like, that's 10% of it. The other stuff, the skill building, the giving them the tools, the practicing and like learning about emotional regulation, that's 90% of it. That's where you're really going to see a difference in like how hard moments kind of play out.
Okay. This is super helpful. So in a situation where safety is more apparently relevant, like hitting, and a boundary is just going to be, you know, I'm going to hold your hand, or we're going to move over here, it might feel more clear what that boundary looks like. But what about when it's around, you know, sharing or cooperating, you know, to like leave the park, or something that doesn't seem to clearly involve safety as an issue? Like, how, what actually goes on in that moment where there is a tantrum, where there is upset, but it's related to, you know, one of those kinds of categories? And you feel like you have a good sense of what needs to happen, like it's time to leave the park, or like it would be nice if you shared with your sister Sally, or we have to get to the airport now, you know, but it's not clear that there's like a boundary that would be invoked.
I think the first thing with those sort of situations is that you have to kind of step back and ask yourself, like, is this a boundary that I actually want to uphold? Because I think a lot of times parents especially as little kids, get like so exhausted and so burnt out because they're trying to hold like 18,000 boundaries a day. And it's like, you could drop most of those because they're not really important. Like, sharing is something that I talk about sometimes. I think there's this like weird thing in kid world about like forced sharing. And it's such a bizarre concept because like adults don't force share with each other, but yet with little kids, we're like, you have to share with your brother. It's been 5 minutes. It's time to share with your brother. And I'm like, that's really weird. Like, we don't do that as grownups. So we practice like being patient. Hey, if my brother has that and I want a turn, I can say, can I have a turn when you're done? And then like my job in that moment is to like be there to block the toddler from like snatching things out of his brother's hand because he has to learn how to be patient. So like, I just think a lot of boundaries are like power struggles that we don't need. So we can drop them because they're just kind of weird. If it's things like, you know, it's time to leave the playground, then I feel like my approach has always been to start from an energy of like playfulness and fun and curiosity. I think that's going to get you cooperation way more than anything else, way more than, you know, like we were talking about with the airplane, threats or bribes. Or I mean, parents sometimes even will be like, the park is closing, it's time to go. And like, I understand why they do that because they're trying to avoid a tantrum, but I feel like it backfires. Like, you can just be honest with your toddler. Like, you can just show them the respect of being honest. And so I'm always going to approach a situation with like fun and playfulness, especially with little kids, you know, telling them to hop like a kangaroo to the car. Something is going to get them to move with you a lot more easy. But yes, I mean, sometimes they don't want to leave. And that's where I would pick them up and I would say, I know you don't want to leave. It's really sad to leave the park. We've got to go now. And like, me carrying them to the car would be the boundary. Again, not coming from this place of like, if you don't stop throwing a tantrum, that we're never coming to the park again. Like, they're allowed to be sad about leaving the park. I'm allowed to still continue to leave. You know what I mean? I think that like my overall approach is just very respectful because I tend to try and like, if it's a boundary like that where we need to move or we need to do something, like I'm always going to do my best to keep their world in the front of my mind, right? Like, if they're in the middle of building a sandcastle and I can wait 10 more minutes before we need to leave because they're so focused on something, I'm going to do that because I would want that kind of awareness and thoughtfulness towards me too. So I think that that's just a piece of it too, is like, when kids are little, I think it's very easy to see them as like this little human that you can just control. You can pick them up, you can move them, you can kind of do whatever you want with them. You're so much bigger as the parent. And it takes a little bit of awareness to stop and be like, what's happening in their world right now? What are they doing? Are they focusing on something? You know, can I give them a minute before I jump in and interrupt, and give them that respect of their personhood, if that makes sense, before we're kind of coming in with these instructions, these boundaries as a parent.
And I think you would probably describe what you're engaging as distinct from like child-centered parenting. So it's not like you're suggesting that, you know, there be this evacuation of the parents, others like, you know, experience, selfhood, priorities in service of, you know, generating the perfect conditions for this child. It sounds like it's more a combination of adult emotional self-regulation and some degree of perspective. I mean, I look back on and sometimes I hear these things, right? So many things that are reflexive tropes, right? Like, brush your teeth. And I mean, I have colleagues who literally think that teeth brushing is a psyop, right? Like, how are we so sure about any of this shit, right? So that we insist needs to be complied with, you know, by these very controllable humans. So some of it comes from just reflexive programming. Some of it comes from, you know, emotional dysregulation in the adult. And so what is the balance between like your own assessment of your priorities, your needs as an adult, and this child, if we're not going to be communicating? And I think that's what makes this conversation interesting, because it's not about verbalization and communication. Yeah. If anything, maybe more about like body language and decision making, right?
Yeah. I mean, you have to be more tuned in. You have to be willing to kind of stop and observe and pay attention a little bit more to the things that they're telling you about. And like, that was something that I picked up very much from like Rye Parenting. And if you've ever heard anything that like Magda Gerber talks about in her philosophy, her research, that is like very much a part of her approach, was like, even when you have a newborn, you can take the time to stop and just watch them for a few minutes and see how much they're noticing, how much awareness they have, how much they focus on the tiny little things, and learning to not interrupt that, or learning to just be aware of the fact that they have like this whole internal world that's happening. And they're not just like a potato that's laying on the bed, right? Like, I feel like especially it starts when they're little and it grows up through when they're a toddler. And people will tell me all the time, like, well, I could say all this stuff to my, you know, 2-year-old, but they'd have no idea what I'm talking about. And I'm like, yes, they do. Even if they're not saying words back to you, they're so capable of understanding so much that's happening around them and showing that back to us, whether it's just through their body language or like sign language or just like watching how they're interacting with the world. You can start to see the things that they're paying attention to and how they're feeling and what they're trying to communicate. And like, obviously, it's not always perfect. You can't always know what a toddler is thinking. But I think it's just that shift in mindset of like, I can pay attention here and I can try and see what needs they have and what's going on in their world and how I can be respectful to that. And then obviously it's just a balance. Like, it's never going to be everything they want all the time, all their needs met perfectly. It's never going to be everything I want, all my needs met perfectly. But it gets to be both a lot of times. And I think also, like, I've seen this with my older kids, my oldest who's almost 6, because I have very particularly like respected her autonomy, her needs, her wishes as part of our daily life. Like, when I need something, when I'm sick, when I don't feel good, when I have a need, I need time by myself. Like, she's so good about respecting that, because that's just part of our family culture, is, you know, being aware of other people and what's going on for them. And it's not this motherhood where I'm just like always the one who's giving, doing everything, serving her. And she's just like, expects that 24/7. So it's cool. Even like, she's not even 6. And I can see that already kind of reflected back in how she exists in our family. So yeah, I mean, I think it's that shift in perspective, that shift in mindset more than anything with our little toddlers, that we can still do that.
I wonder what you feel more generally about concepts like respect and even discipline, right? As this imperative that we have to impose on our kids as parents. Because one of the major jailbreak moments of my life as a mother was when I started to recognize, and actually my work in a modality called family constellation, which everybody listening knows I'm obsessed with, really helped me to see the directional vector of energy that comes, you know, from parent to child and from child to the world, right? It doesn't go in the other direction. That helped me to see, you know, my children owe me nothing, right? I gave them life. They can thank me for that if they want to at some point, but that's literally it. They don't owe me respect. They don't owe me helping around the house. They don't owe me picking up their fucking blocks. Like, they owe me absolutely nothing. Okay. And the fact that I feed them is my choice. The fact that I put a house over their head is my choice. I don't have to do anything for them either. Right? So like, recognizing the agency and the many, many decisions that I make to participate that are my own free will helps to relativize this assumption that, like, because we do all of this, whatever this is, for our kids, that they owe us anything, you know, gratitude, behavioral compliance, you know, support, assistance, whatever. So that comes more naturally when you can, you know, invoke the I thou gaze with your child and see their divinity, right? Like, see them as these spiritual equals, if you will, rather than, you know, some sort of you know, lesser class citizens. So I wonder, yeah, like what do you think generally about this idea of respect and, you know, because it's such a common trope. I'm sure you hear it too. Like, well, but how am I ever going to teach them to respect adults? And how am I ever going to, you know, they need to learn discipline, right? Like, I'm guessing you feel, right? Like there's not even much of a role for these kinds.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the way that most people use those words isn't really how they were intended or what they even really mean. I think those words often are just a word that's kind of used to imply control, which really you have to step out of this perspective and this experience where being the parent equals being in control and being able to control everything. And I mean, the only thing you can do at that point is start going further and further into like manipulative and fear-based tactics. And the thing about that I think a lot of people don't realize, like especially in the young years, is it can seem like that quote unquote works in the little years because it's easy to control a three-year-old, right? It's easy to control a five-year-old. You're literally in charge of their whole existence. They don't know anything outside of you. Like you're their home, you're their food. You're huge compared to that. Like it's very easy to manipulate and control a little kid into listening or obeying or being polite or whatever. But as they get bigger, that tactic is not going to work anymore. It becomes very apparent, I think, when a lot of people get to the teenage years and it doesn't work anymore. And you have to kind of go harsher and harsher and harsher with your punishments or your tactics to get a 16-year-old to listen to you. Because there's no connection there. There's no actual like relational currency there. It's you've completely severed that relationship. And the only thing that's left is fear. And so I would much rather focus on, I think, what the intent for the word respect is, which is actually building this connection, this currency. People always talk about like, well, I'm the parent. I need to have authority. You can't have authority over somebody unless you have influence over them. You can't have influence over somebody if there's no connection or currency between you. So I would much rather build that relationship. I would much rather focus on strengthening the trust and the emotional understanding and the bond between us in easy moments and in hard moments when there's, you know, mistakes or tricky things that come up, because I know that's going to be valuable the older they get, and that's going to continue to strengthen and grow. And I think similarly, like people use the word discipline when what they're really saying is punishment. And if you actually look at what discipline means, it means to disciple, to guide, to show the way. And that's very much like you focused as the parent. How are you showing up? How are you regulating your own emotions? How are you existing as a human? How are you handling hard moments in front of your kids? Like that's really what's going to end up being the discipline throughout their childhood. And it's going to stick with them instead of like trying to get them kind of to comply or behave properly or obey or any of those things that, again, are very like control focused.
So I want to talk a bit about consequences and natural consequences, because, you know, again, I've come to a pretty radical, not so radical in like the unschooling world, but a radical perspective on, you know, what is to be expected of our kids. And you know, well, like one of those things is like cleaning up or helping out. And I've shared, you know, the example that I don't ask my kids to clean their room. I have nothing to do with their laundry. And in their dad's house, it's a different, you know, I would say more normative, like set of expectations. And in my house, their rooms are always clean. They're always clean. And it's literally a non-issue. And my interpretation of that is that they have like a connection to intrinsic motivation. Like they actually give a shit what their rooms feel like. And so they know when is a good time. Like my one daughter always cleans her room on Sunday. I have never suggested that. I've never, you know, prompted her around that. And she does it because it feels good to her to start her week off with a clean room. So when we don't have the opportunity to develop intrinsic motivation, we're only ever caretaking, you know, for our environment or ourselves because of other people's expectation. And I wonder, you know, what I can't remember really, but like maybe I used to say like, hey, clean up your blocks or your markers or then we'll go, you know, we'll go after you clean it up. And it, do they need to clean up? Right? Like, is that, is, how do they learn the natural consequence of messiness if we're constantly regulating that? And do they even care about messiness? So I don't know. I've sort of like spiraled out into like, wow, I have no idea how I would approach this with a young kid. And where is the line between these like arbitrarily manufactured, fictitious consequences and rules and the ones that actually do exist and might serve to support the development of that intrinsic motivation and relationship to care, you know, for the environment than like management?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're still like figuring that out with our kids being really little, but definitely we have leaned very heavily into developing intrinsic motivation and not kind of squashing that. Cause I think it is really easy to squash that when you, from a very young age, start pairing chores or anything like that with a reward system. I mean, even like potty training comes to mind. People always will do like M&Ms or sticker charts or things with potty training. And I'm like, you could just not do that and it will be fine. Like everybody learns how to pee on the toilet on their own. Like it's, they don't need a sticker for it. It just, it adds this like weird level again of like control to the situation that I feel like doesn't need to be there. And I think something that we've done in our house is, again, it's very much like modeling. It plays a big role. And then when they're younger, having conversations and helping them start to connect feelings to like situations. So, I mean, even with like my 5-year-old, she is like so creative that her room can get so chaotic, right? She's got like markers and puzzles and books and lovies and things everywhere. And she's pretty young still. So I think it's hard for her to kind of make the connection in her brain sometimes of like, I'm feeling overwhelmed because of the situation here. So instead of me just being like, you need to clean your room today, it's like, hey, you seem like you're feeling like you're a little overwhelmed. You're a little frustrated because you can't find your stuff. Let's observe what's going on in your room. And let's talk about how like sometimes it can be hard to concentrate when our room is crazy. Like, should we talk about a plan for how we can handle that? And then it becomes this like collaborative effort where they have that internal reflection. Obviously, a 2-year-old isn't really having those sort of conversations. And for a 2-year-old, it's really like me modeling or talking about that out loud, or even just like, I give my kids like one toy in the living room, two toys in the living room, because I know for myself, if there's 800 toys everywhere, I'm going to be overwhelmed. And so that's even something I can say out loud is like, we're going to take some of these out of here because it's too much for me. Like it's making me feel overwhelmed. And they're just absorbing that, but they're kind of learning to connect those things together again, intrinsically, instead of like you clean your room and you get a dollar every Sunday. Cause then there's no meaning to it. It's just, like you said, has that extrinsic value to it. And then you kind of, again, you have to keep like upping the reward to make them want to do things. And it becomes a really slippery slope, I think.
Yeah. And what I've noticed too is that when it is a control-based and fear-based tactic, there often isn't the effort to teach, to educate. You know, like I actually discovered this around a lot of subjects, you know, whether it was talking to my girls about buying natural cosmetics or eating the right food, or even like tech, like how to relate to tech. It was just like, that's the rule. That's the good way to do it. And then there's the bad way to do it. And I'm going to be upset if you do it the bad way. And often there isn't, right? Like, did you teach your kid how to clean? Like, how the frig are they supposed to know how to clean? Like, there's no effort. And it's just about, I don't like this. It feels bad in my adult system. You make it better, kid, right? And when there is that intention, like you're suggesting, you're on the ground with them. And I don't know, maybe you would say something like, I think it would feel good for me if I put this away, her stuff, right? Because that's really what it's about. It's like, I think it's Byron Katie who says like, if you don't want the sock on the floor, pick up the sock. Right? Like if it's bothering you that it's there, you do something about it. Because, you know, even with teenagers, my girls don't do, you know, dishes and that kind of a thing. If things pile up in the sink, I'm the one who's going to do it. And so every once in a while, I'll be like, well, when they're on their own, how are they ever going to know how to, you know, clean a dish? And so that actually incentivized me to make sure they actually know how to do it. And then if they do it or don't do it, like, I'm the one who's bothered. Right? So like, if I'm going to do it, then maybe even I could do it from like a devotional place. Like, I am caring for these beings. I actually have the opportunity and honestly privilege to live with in this time before they go off into the world. Is it that really, is it really that big a deal? Is it that deep? Or, you know, I could say like, you need to learn because that'll make you a better adult out there at some point. Meanwhile, you're sacrificing this, like you said, this moment that you do have with your kids. So there's like a very different on the ground energy. So I wonder too, if you could speak about sibling dynamics and like how, what I would describe as like your minimalist approach. Like it sounds very minimalist, like just pause more, you know, observe more, regulate yourself more and, right? Like engage and interfere less. And sometimes, you know, when sibling conflict comes up, it really invokes that triangle, especially, you know, if you just have two kids, it invokes that triangular dynamic almost immediately where you know, feel inclined to take a side and make sense out of what's happening and give your purview on the whole situation. And, you know, again, I have teenagers. It's not often that this comes up, but when it does, I have like a method if I'm in the room where, you know, I'll ask if they want me to, you know, hold, you know, this conversation, and I'll ask them to say like, and I feel a sentence, basically like an I'd love sentence. And then I'm willing to, right? So like, I feel is like their victim story. It's like, I feel like you always do this and you always take my top and whatever. And then it's, I'd love is like, what do you want of her, right? Like, what do you want her to do? And then I'm willing to is like, what could you offer, right? So like some permutation of those three, and it works, you know. Also my kids, for reasons I can't entirely understand, are incredibly emotionally mature. So they, you know, they can work it out without my help, I'm sure. But in exploring this with them, I often think like, wow, well, how does it work? How would it work with toddlers? Like, I don't even know how that gets applied, because you end up, right, like intervening on behalf of one, I imagine. And that sets up this triangular dynamic where one is the bad one and one is the good one. What is the best approach for conflicts that arise?
Yeah, sibling stuff, I feel like is one of those things that is the most triggering to parents. And very often it ends up with this energy of coming in and you see one kid as the victim and one kid as the perpetrator. And then the more that that happens, the more it creates a divide between them, and then the more conflict that happens, and it just turns into this bad cycle. I mean, I always think back, I was at the playground a few years ago, and there was this dad with twins, a boy and a girl who were probably three, and he was like paying attention to their older kid, and the two twins were under the playground, and the girl bit her brother. I watched it. She bit her brother on the leg, and then he kicked her because, like, instinctually, because she bit him. The dad turned just in time to see the brother kick the sister and like yelled at the brother so much, was instantly like, why would you do that? That was not nice. Like, set him to time out, was like cuddling the girl. And I was just thinking like, wow, he has no idea of the whole situation that just happened there. And that me, like the boy was, you know, he was hurt. He had something happen to him too, but it's just like this instinct to come in and be like, you're right, you're wrong. And so I very much try and approach any sibling fighting from a very neutral perspective of, they both have a thing going on, and my job is to help them bridge the communication gap, which obviously, like, the younger they are, the harder it is. And it's more of just like making sure they're not whacking each other with toys. But like, as they get older, my job is not to decide who was right and who was wrong. Even if I like watched something happen, it's to help them communicate. And so I'm very much will always come in and I'll kind of make sure they're physically separated. And then it's just like giving each kid a turn. Hey, tell me your story. What happened to you? You tell me your story. What happened? And then like, how can we fix this? What can we do moving forward? And that has made a huge difference. I mean, my kids are still little. They still wrestle and fight and push each other over and like normal stuff. But like, I can see my 3 and my 5-year-old 75% of the time have a conflict, start kind of like yelling at each other, going at each other, and then they'll like pause and they'll kind of figure it out on their own. And I feel like that's a really impressive thing for a 3 and a 5-year-old to be able to do. And I think it is due to that approach, like very similar to what you do with your girls of my job isn't to decide who was right or who was wrong. My job is to help make sure that like nobody's hurting each other and to help them figure out a better way of problem solving. I mean, I think another part of it is like giving them space to problem solve a little bit and not just like jumping in the first time I hear them starting to bicker or argue or kind of coming into the room to be the problem solver. Like you have to give them the space to be able to practice that skill. And then like, if I can hear it devolve into the place where they're just like kicking at each other or something, then I'll come in and help move the situation along. But like they don't ever grow that skill and be able to kind of handle conflict if you don't give them that space. But I mean, it also goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of like, you have to be okay with there being conflict and not seeing that as bad, but seeing that as just part of like a healthy relationship. And it's okay if there's conflict sometimes and they sometimes are feeling angry, frustrated, mad, upset, whatever at each other.
Right. Which of course tracks back to your being able to hold that in your own system. Yeah. Amazing. Okay. So I want to wrap up with just sort of neon lights around some of the patterns that, you know, moms listening might be unconsciously engaging in so that perhaps they could be given pause or at least develop a little bit of witness consciousness around some of these habits. So I wonder if you could share a couple of your like, these cycles must end, you know, things that you see in your clients and in your friends and family in the world, or maybe even that you committed to neither no longer engaging or not engaging period based on your own lineage. Like what are some of the things that you think we really need to look at a better, I know you've mentioned some of them, but we really need to look at a better way.
Yeah. One thing I think that comes up a lot that was a big thing for me and that I see with my clients a lot is giving yourself space as a mom for your needs to still be important. And that kind of wraps in with like everything that I talk about. But I always think of how moms will often say like, I can't even pee without my toddler being on my lap. And I'm always trying to remind people like you can. It's okay if you set your toddler outside the door and they sit there and they cry for 10 seconds while you're peeing on your own. Like, I think that's one of the biggest things is this idea that we have to be like such a sacrificial martyr that we have absolutely no space for our own needs. And you can't be a healthy present mom from that space. The only thing that it does is kind of further dysregulate you. And so I think that's a big thing is just being okay with putting boundaries around what you need as a mom, like as cheesy as that sounds, and being okay with your kids being upset about it. Like it's okay if they feel like they don't appreciate that you went to the bathroom for 5 minutes by yourself. So I think that's a big one. I think the other one is just this piece of kind of trying to control your toddler all day and just recognizing how many decisions you're making from a place of like, this isn't how it's supposed to be, or this isn't how I imagined it to be. And then getting into like the power struggles. Like I said earlier, I think a lot of moms would enjoy motherhood a lot more if they weren't constantly in this like power struggle with their toddler about everything all day long. And they just like let 90% of it go and learned to be okay with their toddler, their little kid kind of being their own person, having their own existence. So, I mean, stuff like as little as if your toddler wants to put his shoes on the wrong feet, it's really okay. They can wear their shoes on the wrong feet. If they want to paint with their finger instead of the paintbrush, like it'll be okay. Just like all those little things that I feel like add up all day because we just want to like grip onto the control so tightly. And then it causes a lot of conflict that doesn't need to be there.
There's so much about the resolution of this
victim triangle dynamic pattern in our lives that is just about getting on the same team, right? Like, how can you be on the same team with your partner? How can you be on the same team with your body? And how can you be on the same team with your kid? You know, like I was reflecting the other day on the fact that I don't know that I have ever like shit talked my kids, like ever, and probably quite the contrary. And how I just, you know, I know so many of us grew up just like overhearing our parents, you know, talking shit about us to their friends, to the other parent. And how can you give your child the impression that you are on your child's team and that trust is there when these habits? And again, if nobody's pointed this out, it's like you might not even wake up from the spell. And so what you're suggesting is like, you know, like I wonder if every time you say no to your kid, right? Like how many times a day does a mom say, no, 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 do that. It's just like the same way we treat our husbands, you know, it's like the same way we interact with our bodies. It's the same way we interact with the world as women who are fundamentally out of touch with the deep fears that drive our embodied existence. So if you look at how many times a day you are micromanaging and regulating your child's behavior, I mean, even as you're talking, I feel like, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like, it's okay. You know, it's like zoom out a bit and experience even the, you know, it's like as I come to the end of this like 18-year, you know, tenure with my daughters, I just feel this, like a cry about it. I just feel this like grasping, almost like scarcity, you know, like it's almost over. It's 18 years for most of us. I mean, that's it. That's it. In the whole span of your life that you get to live with these humans and be with them and co-create with them and experience them, like, does it really fucking matter if they, you know, like color on the walls? Like, who cares? So it's that relativizing perspective that I, you know, that I get from you. And also, of course, the same messaging, you know, that I'm, you know, on the mountaintops delivering, which is just about the importance of emotional self-mastery as a woman in your relationships. So amazing, Cassie, thank you. And I want to make sure that because you are offering support directly to moms that women know how to find you and what they can avail themselves of.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me. So you can find me at Cassie Mom Coach, kind of across the board, website, Instagram, TikTok, anything like that. And then, yeah, I have a ton of like very accessible guides that kind of cover both sides of the spectrum. I have my Wild Hands Activity Guide, which I love so much, which is very much focused on like activities and games and things that your little kids can do to start teaching them how to regulate their body. That is very much like if you are in the trenches, if you feel like your toddler is like wild, crazy, has huge emotions all the time, like get that. It's so good to start giving them, like I had mentioned before, the actual skills and tools to kind of regulate their body. And then on the other side, guides around regulating yourself as a mom, noticing your triggers, moving through that, how to kind of, you know, tune back into your nervous system and your fight or flight response is happening all the time, and regulate yourself so that you can be more grounded and calm for your kids. So I have that too. And you can kind of start wherever is going to be the best for you.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Cassie, for contributing to the root cause resolution of so much of what we're dealing with as adults. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.